Ladies and gentlemen, one thing I will not be giving up in exchange for great musical talent from God anytime soon is coffee. I enjoy a great cup of joe perhaps even more than I enjoy smiting my professional rivals. And I love smiting my professional rivals. And like most coffee lovers, I know that the difference between a good cup of coffee and the best cup of coffee is fresh roasted beans. Unfortunately, like God-given musical talent, fresh roasted coffee beans can be a little hard to come by. Or at least they used to be, because now they're Sparkplug Coffee! Sparkplug Coffee is a service that roasts your beans when you order them and delivers them straight to your house within a week. Sparkplug's scientific process ensures consistently high-quality coffee with blends to suit any taste, from light to dark and even half-calf, so you can drink twice as much! Sparkplug offers autopilot, set-it-and-forget-it delivery so that you never run out and you'll never again have to drink that stale stuff from the grocery store. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Dankeschön for downloading the Top 107 Project, our rapidly ending quest to review all 123 of the motion pictures on American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists. If you don't know jack about Amadeus and don't want it wrecked for you, you should know we're about to wreck it. I am Ryan Ellis with my musical muse, my wife Bev.
That's me.
That's two times I've tried that laugh. I'm probably failing, but who can laugh like Tom Hulse in Amadeus? So, the coming attractions trivia for this film. What are the three movies that ranked higher than Amadeus on the 1998 AFI Top 100 and then, like Amadeus, missed the cut in 2007? Very easy to find. Did you do it?
I did it. The first one is number 52, which was From Here to Eternity. Birth of a Nation at 44. And the last one at 39 was Dr. Zhivago. Mm-hmm.
There's a whole stretch, actually, in this with From Here to Eternity, Amadeus, and a few others. I think the third man's in there that got knocked off. And we've probably made very clear that Dr. Zhivago at 39 is a monumental drop. And Amadeus and Dr. Zhivago have some things in common. Their costume, movies, set in the past, pretty successful with audiences. Zhivago, much more so. But they weren't around in 2007. All right, let's get into it then. The Top 100 Project's 107th movie, Amadeus, was 53rd on the 1998 Top 100 list between fellow Best Picture Oscar winners, we just said this one, From Here to Eternity, and All Quiet on the Western Front. Amadeus premiered on September 6, 1984. Then Orion rolled it out slowly later that month. The film didn't have a big budget, but it made a tidy profit for a studio that went bankrupt a decade later. To explain what this film's about, Bev will give you the skinny on Amadeus.
Tom Hulse portrays Austrian musical genius Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, whose brilliance is matched only by his insouciance and vulgarity. F. Murray Abraham plays Antonio Salieri, the emperor's musical consort, who's talented, but he's no Mozart. The knowledge that he can never be great consumes Salieri, and many suffer for it, especially Mozart.
Or, in a nutshell, petty man's war on God kills goofy genius. Or, many nights at the opera. The Rotten Tomatoes numbers, 95% of critics liked it, 75% fresh, 4% rotten, same number, 95% of audiences liked the movie. It's also 92nd on the IMDb's top 250. Which is pretty high. There are movies that people love more, including 2001 A Space Odyssey. Monumental, legendary classic that is. And yet Amadeus does outrank it.
I'm surprised.
And it was far from the top 10 of the 1984 U.S. box office. Ghostbusters was the smash hit of 1984. Beverly Hills Cop was also a huge monster hit. In fact, it was the biggest R-rated comedy or R-rated movie period for a very long time. But Amadeus was 12th, so a respectable number. That's enough of the numbers. There aren't really any more to talk about right now, so let's hear about your thoughts.
My initial impression was that this was a surprise addition to the list, but the more I try to convince myself that it doesn't belong on the top 100, the more I find myself finding in its favor. It's a movie that does something new. It breathes fresh life into the period drama. It makes movies like Dr. Zhivago seem insufferably stuffy and phony. It's really fun. It's full of tremendous performances. It has beautiful, deep language, elegant expressions of theme. My only criticism, it really does lose steam in the last act, but compare that to the entire last 40 minutes of Ben-Hur. I think it deserves the praise. I think it's a great movie, and I'm a little bummed that it got knocked off the list.
For a moment there, I thought you said Dr. Strangelove, and I wasn't really listening to the next few things that you said because I thought, what has this got to do with a comedy and satire of nuclear war?
And I would never criticize Dr. Strange for any reason whatsoever.
Right. I like the movie. I like the movie quite a bit. It was one of my favorite movies of 84. I'm looking over my past top 10 lists, if that means anything anymore. I think I had it something like fourth that year. I definitely do like the movies I mentioned that were bigger hits that year, Ghostbusters and Beverly Hills Cop. I'll watch them many more times. And this one I hadn't seen in 13 years. I saw it on the big screen, one of the few movies that we've covered that I did see that way. They re-released it in 2002, and a friend and I went to see the director's cut. That's the DVD we watched as well. I've not seen theatrical cut in a very long time, and probably never will again. There's some important additions, and we'll get to those in a few minutes. So it's a movie that I would say absolutely big thumbs up. As an AFI Top 100, if it was going to be on at all, maybe in the 80s or 90s, I said this about Sophie's Choice last week. This has a little bit more going for it that has pretty much just Meryl Streep's legendary performance. This has a lot of other awards going for it. It was a bigger hit, and it's probably a more rewatchable movie. It's more fun, for one thing.
Mm.
Tom Hulce as Mozart really makes that happen, and even Salieri, played by F. Murray Abraham, is so serious, but he's funny at times, playing it dead straight. But I don't think I could find room for it on my list when Ghostbusters, for example, did not make it.
I was going through the list to see if there's any other proper European costume dramas on the list. Not old aristocratic Europe, which we always think of as this standard frequent film genre, but it's the only one on the list that's like that. I mean, you come close with things like Gone with the Wind, Wuthering Heights, but those are very American.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very unique biopic. It's a unique take on the historical costume
because
drama.
The character in the title is not the character that we spend the most time with. He's a supporting player in the film. And it's also, you just said about the American thing, it's debatably American at all. The actors primarily are American, so I guess that's what makes it that way. But this is kind of the David Lean thing all over again. With Bridge on the River Kwai, you had William Holden and some of the other actors. But other than Holden of the main stars, it was British actors, or Sessue Hayakawa, I think I said that name right, the Japanese actor who were not American. Dr. Zhivago and Lawrence of Arabia, more so. You've got people born from other countries who are the star of an AFI film. But then there are the American actors, not using accents, incidentally. Meryl Streep would be horrified by that. We just came off a movie with a woman who uses multiple accents and was rewarded for that. And these actors aren't even trying to do anything else, but the director, Milos Forman, told them, just play the characters and we won't worry about any of that stuff.
I think it's the right choice. I think it kind of points out how silly and stuffy the whole British accent thing is.
Well, none of these people would have had British accents either, but that's always been the staple in a Hollywood film. If you're going to play somebody from some other country, primarily in Europe, you're going to sound like you're from England, even though Salieri and a few of the other characters are Italian, and then the rest of them, well, most of the rest of them at least, are Austrian.
But you don't notice it. It doesn't take from the film at all. As a matter of fact, it kind of adds to the film because it's their natural accents, and it just makes it feel that much more natural, and that's what makes Amadeus stand out. It feels so believable and authentic and natural compared to every costume drama you've ever seen that it's hard to stop them from looking really staged. That's one of the details that saves it from that.
One of the authentic touches, on the other hand, though, is that the musical notes you see on screen are what are played on screen. I guess Tom Hulce and Abraham learned music, and the other people for that matter too, well enough that when you see a note being played on a piano, on the other instruments for that matter, that's what's there. And generally, people will notice that kind of stuff. I would never know that. But some music person watching the movie, same as military movies, they're going to notice, well, the stars on his shoulder aren't the right ones for a sergeant. I'm probably wrong about that. The bars, excuse me. See, I don't know anything about this stuff.
The same way it's hard for you and I to watch movies about people who make podcasts because, you know, we're
such
like,
experts.
That's not how it works, man. No, they would never do it in that room. The noise would never work out.
Our room is so soundproofed, We got people beside us and planes above us. Actually, the thing that gets a better comparison for us as TV people is when they make television happen, that movie Vantage Point, which was kind of fun but really stupid, and the early sequences where they show them in a production truck. I went with people who are in the business with me way back when that movie came out, and we spent the first 30 minutes talking out loud and mocking it. I don't like doing that in the theaters, but we did in that one case because it was so badly done.
There was a million reasons that we had to stop watching HBO's The Newsroom, mostly because it was just such an atrociously, embarrassingly bad show all around, but its portrayal of how a television show gets made was also just unwatchable from our perspective because we knew too much.
Aaron Sorkin's made other TV shows about making TV, and I don't know about those ones, I've never seen them, but he really got it wrong in that case. Let's get back to Amadeus, though. And it is a stage-to-screen musical of sorts. It was a play first. Peter Schaffer wrote that. And the opening credit is Peter Schaffer's Amadeus. We haven't seen that a lot in the project. Francis Ford Coppola is good for that. So it was Mario Puzo's The Godfather and Mario Puzo's The Godfather Part 2. Coppola does that with other people too. Bram Stoker, the one he did with Dracula. Yeah. It was Bram Stoker's Dracula. So this is Schaffer's movie. And Milos Forman, who did a great job directing it and won another Oscar after he did for Cuckoo's Nest way back when, is always given plenty of credit to the writer. A lot of times writers are pushed out of credits. We talked about that in Tootsie just a couple of weeks ago. Larry Gelbart still holds a grudge against Dustin Hoffman because of the way the credit worked out with that one and how Hoffman has taken too much in Gelbart's opinion. In this case, you got a director saying, hey, this is his movie as much as mine. And they do a commentary together that I listened to a long time ago. And they're pretty supportive of each other. It's nice to hear. And I said, before we did Nashville, which is another musical of sorts that we covered, that was a little while ago, 1975, same year as Cuckoo's Nest, actually, also up against Forman's movie for the Oscar that year, but Forman's movie did win. But I said before, when it was, I guess, Cabaret, it was our last musical on the list, now we've had two others that are debatably musicals. Mm-hmm. But in both cases, it's musical settings, and actually Cabaret was too, where music actually happens where it's supposed to. It isn't just people are talking about something. I love Singin' the Rain, but good morning... which is, of course, pretty phony. The movie is also one of those sit-down-and-let-me-tell-you-a-story-and-flashback-type films because primarily the story is set as a flashback. We haven't seen that a lot in the project. It's something you see all the time in movies made now. So often, the thing they do now, especially in action films, is you just see a scene from the middle of the film and then it'll be 5 months ago and then it catches up to that moment. This one is all about, well, I'm wearing this old-age makeup and let's just tell you why I'm in this insane asylum. And there you go, Milos Forman back in the insane asylum after being in it with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Amadeus translates to God's Beloved. And this movie, more than any other that we ever will cover, most movies you're ever going to see, period, unless it is a religious film, mentions God a lot. And that's why I said in the nutshell that it's petty man's war on God, the petty man being Salieri. Mm-hmm.
It's my suspicion that Forman doesn't want the audience to believe that God has anything to do with it. I think the statement, if anything, that he's making is fate is cruel, life's not fair, God doesn't reward piety... And some people are just born with it.
And he also doesn't punish somebody who is a crass, vulgar idiot. Mm. Mozart is portrayed in the film, and I don't know if this is actually based on any truth or not, but in the story of the film, Mozart doesn't deserve to be, as Salieri believes him to be, the one who's touched by God. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like in Bull Durham, in many movies actually, but in Bull Durham, the Tim Robbins character is a goofy idiot. I never thought of this comparison until right this minute, actually. But Kevin Costner's Salieri, oh my God, I never thought of the influence. I didn't have a lot of influence for this film. There's one right there, one of my favorite movies ever, Bull Durham. Yeah, Costner's Salieri, and Robbins is Mozart. And it's this guy who's special, who doesn't really earn it, who doesn't even really take care of his gift. They're younger. The other guys have seen more of the world, and they realize, I want to be that good. I can see something that you can't see, even though you're way more just obviously gifted than I am. But that's the real tragedy of this film. Well, tragedy from the bad guy, because Salieri is that. But he sees the greatness he can never have, and the guy who's way better than he is, as good as Salieri is in his own right, just like Costner, Robbins, and Bull Durham, that's the torture. It's almost like, if I could be blessed with anything, if I couldn't be as good as I want to be, then don't let me see that I'm not as good as I want to be.
Yeah, don't let me know and have that knowledge. He's also definitely addressing the point, sometimes it doesn't matter how hard you work. This goes counter to the whole American ethos right now. This whole, you can be whoever you want to be.
Can't.
This movie's saying, no, actually, you can. You can be good. Salieri works his way to a very good position. I think we said after the film, most musicians, most people who care that much,
would
that
kill
passionate
for that.
About music, you get to make your living, and a damn good living, as a musician. That is better than most people who are passionate about something ever get to experience.
And he has power, he has influence,
but it's
he's
never
big
enough
the emperor.
For him. Yeah, but he knows that he's not that good. He knows that he's mediocre.
And that's the thing. We can all relate way more to Salieri, not trying to destroy somebody else who's better than us. But most of us are mediocre. As you were saying your point a minute ago, I'm picturing my own head as I'm 41 years old playing with people who are 10 years younger than me. I brought this point up before in other podcasts. Playing softball. I have always tried hard. I've never been nearly as physically gifted as a lot of my friends and teammates, and I don't hold that against them. It's not their fault. I don't know that some of them even realize how good they are, and if I had even a tenth of that ability, well, okay, I have a tenth maybe, but if I had half their ability, how much I would celebrate that. But maybe me not being religious, I don't blame anybody for the fact, why does he get that? He doesn't even nurture, he doesn't care.
Well, you haven't given anything up. Salieri makes this bargain with God, who's clearly not listening. And he gives up. Although, I mean, how much does he actually give up? There's no indication that he really cares that much about sex or women. He has a crush on the student. He's never had sex,
according to what the movie portrays.
But he doesn't seem very sexual. They never portray it as a big sacrifice on his part. He has a crush on that one student. But you kind of get the impression that he was just satisfied in her company, and he was upset that Mozart got her. But if he had given up sweets for his musical
there
gift,
are more sweets in the movie than there
yeah, maybe
sex.
I could, yeah, absolutely. But I think that's his vice. It's not sex. I don't think he really was giving anything up when he gave up sex.
Let's put ourselves in Salieri's shoes for a minute. If you were in his position and you wanted something that you already hadn't achieved, and you probably knew that even before you saw Mozart or heard his music, you've also heard the music before you've seen the person. And then he thinks it's just some young goofball messing around with Stanzi, who becomes Mozart's wife in the future, Elizabeth Berridge. And that part could have been Meg Tilly's, but then she had to drop out because she suffered an injury when she was just playing with her son or something like that, when she wasn't even making a movie. She was in The Big Chill the year before that. Could have been an even bigger star than she probably already was, and she has had a pretty good career. Elizabeth Berridge hadn't made a movie in 3 years, and then her biggest credits I can find in the IMDb would be her appearance on The John Larroquette Show, and then Hidalgo, the Viggo Mortensen movie that he made after the Lord of the Rings films came out. She's fine in the movie, and she's actually very likable and cute for the most part. And as we point out, back in this era, we've always think about the Puritanism of the many centuries before ours. Well, here's an example. I guess the French, that was also a thing that they had. But in Austria, you've got people with their cleavage, but really almost down to the nipple showing.
Yeah.
And then their breasts pumped up as well, I'm sure, by some kind of corset. And then that leads us into the one definite nude scene. I can't remember if there's any others, but she definitely plays a nude scene very briefly. And this is one of the additions in the director's cut. I think it's absolutely vital to the film because it plays on so many levels. She's willing to prostitute herself to this guy, and then we never really find out why Salieri doesn't go through with it. Is it just that he wants to play with her and that messes with Mozart? Does he want to imply to Mozart, I could have had your woman, or maybe even that I did have your woman? Is it that he wants to go through with it and then realizes he can't after all because he is a virgin?
I think he never expected her to come back to his room. He was just messing with her, and he never had any intention of following through on his offer to get Mozart that job that he was going to give in exchange for sexual favors. And he was a virgin, and I don't think he's interested in sex. So when she presented herself to him, he just didn't know where to go from there because he hadn't really anticipated that possibility.
Mm-hmm. And she just drops her top, and there you go, Elizabeth Berridge showing it all.
It's a great scene, though, the way that they play off each other. And it sets up her loathing for him for the rest of the film as well.
Because on the IMDb, they point out it doesn't make a ton of sense as to why she's so angry at him when he's with Mozart, as Mr. Wolfgang is dying of consumption or whatever it is that he's been...
cirrhosis.
I guess that's it.
Maybe a combination,
But drinking too much. And that's another aspect of this film, is that Mozart in their world is poor. It doesn't look like he's poor compared to what we think of as somebody who has no money now. But in their world, he's broke. And isn't that another thing that plays into our modern time? You got this young, starving artist who wants something so badly, who's been tamped down. Not just by Salieri, in fact. The other Italians. Yeah. Oh, those damn Italians. None of these people, Salieri understands it certainly better than the other ones do, but none of them can relate to this musical genius, even Salieri. But they're the ones that have the power to say, no, 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 no. You know who can really relate to this film? If you want to put it in that context, filmmaking and the Mozart character as much as anybody, it'd be Orson Welles.
Just about any director probably fights that
But fight. Orson Welles was definitely special above almost everybody else who ever made films. And now Mozart obviously made an awful lot of great music that is still being played today and will be played forever. But Welles could have been an even bigger star as a director and an actor and producer than he ever was. But he was essentially held down by the Hollywood community. And I'm sure at least part of it was similar to this whole thing of, well, the line that's in the movie, too many notes.
Yeah.
What does that even mean?
And even just the huffy propriety that they all practice and the way they expect everybody to follow protocol and treat them with this respect and reverence that they haven't earned in so long that a new person wouldn't even understand why they deserve it.
Mm-hmm.
And that passion is such a big part of this film because it's something that both Mozart and Salieri share is this incredible, really well-drawn, infectious passion for music. I love the scenes where Salieri goes to Mozart's place, even when they're in the vaudeville theater. He always goes to his performances, and in some cases, every single one of the performances, because as much as he hates Mozart, he just can't help himself from loving his music. Yeah. That passion is always what drives him.
What does he call him in his voiceover? Or it's not his voiceover, I guess, it's his speaking over the movie because he's talking to the priest, the reverend, whatever the hell it is, the guy that he's given the big flashback sequence to.
Doesn't he call him God's beloved?
No, but he has a defamatory word he uses for him.
What
not
is
a
it?
Swear. It's very G-rated. He calls him the creature.
Yes.
I knew the creature had her about one girl.
I love his character.
Does he actually chart as a villain on
no.
the...
No, no, but he's nominated as a villain.
You're talking Salieri here.
Salieri, yeah. Which is amazing because he's so relatable. Like, he really draws on...
this is the dark side of all of us.
Exactly, and I don't care who you are. There's a part of this film where he's the one that you feel for, and we can all relate to that envy.
He also, Salieri here, wishes he had Mozart's tough father and pretty much says as much. He also might as well be saying that he wished he'd had a teacher like Fletcher in Whiplash, that fantastic movie from last year we brought up a few times in our podcast about a teacher who goes way too far to try to inspire his students. But he admits later on in the film Whiplash that he's doing it because people aren't going to be as good by being told, that's not bad. What was it? Good job.
Good
Those
job.
Are the two worst words in the English language, according to Fletcher. And I've said to you more than once about that film, I have mixed feelings. One of the reasons I like the film so much is that I wonder if maybe there's a part of me that wishes I'd had a Fletcher as a kid. That's not good enough. Do it again and again and again. And that's what Salieri wishes he'd had. He had a father that didn't care at all about music. And then Mozart's father pushes him constantly. He is the cliched, cruel father.
A note about Salieri's evil tendencies. I mean, you see right away when he's telling the priest about his vow to God. He considers it evidence that God listened to him because his father chokes and dies right in front of him. And instead of feeling the least bit of remorse or guilt or even grief, he's thrilled. He literally calls it a miracle. Another detail I noticed is in the first part of the film, when he's younger, before he meets Mozart, he's always wearing the wigs.
Mm.
It's after he breaks his vow with God and decides that he's going to ruin Mozart, he stops wearing wigs. Not altogether. He wears them sometimes.
So in public he does.
But in public you see him with just his natural hair and a ponytail. They speak a lot through costumes. A lot of people have written about the wigs that Holtz wears, the Mozart wigs, mm-hmm. and how punk rock they are.
He wishes he had three heads.
I wonder if Salieri not wearing a wig is to say, now that he's fully malicious, this is more his true self. This is mm-hmm. without the artifice of that piety, of that ridiculous oath to God, and that thing that also makes him feel like he's superior to everybody else. He yeah. loves being that disciplined and that perfect all the time, but that's artifice. The real him is cruel. The real him was thrilled that his father died and would like to kill the man who's making the most beautiful music he's ever heard.
Or would like to be him. He'd like to not care what anyone thinks. He'd like to write his music and just say, I'm going to do this, and if you don't let me do it, I'm going to keep on writing anyway. But he's always following the rules. Actually, he's not, but publicly, he's always following the rules. He wants to be Mozart. It's not just that he wants to be that talented with the music stuff. He wants to be him anyway. He's a regular guy. He works hard. He's always working. He also has a pool table, and I love that. He seems to be loyal to his wife and child. He's messed around a little bit, and it's not okay to ever have an affair, I know that, but they don't portray him as the typical rock star, because that's what this movie is also standing in for, is a modern rock star.
Yes.
And he loves his cold father, the Roy Daughtry, yes. is how you say his name, character. 55 years in the business, he mostly did TV, Beauty and the Beast, he ended with Game of Thrones, that was his last ever job, he did a couple of episodes. He also has the Darth Vader outfit.
Mm.
That's what's on the cover, is the picture of his father, although it's also an actor who's trying to mess with Mozart, that Salieri's hired to do that. But this guy that we can't relate to actually, in that sense, his non-talented sense, his non-job sense, the music, Mozart, we can relate to the regular guy as they portray him in this film more than we can Salieri. Because he is the one who's got the ear of the emperor, and he is the one who lives in this ritzy palace. And incidentally, they didn't make very many sets for this film. Almost all of it was shot in Prague, mostly on location, which is pretty impressive considering the opulence of what we're looking at so often in this mm-hmm. movie.
Yeah, the sets are beautiful, the costumes are beautiful. Forman went to a lot of lengths to portray it all as real and fallible and believable. I love Mozart's character. He could so easily have been a demigod, but the music is exceptional. The music is godlike. It reaches that level, but he's very human. He's childish in the best and the worst ways. He's petulant and irresponsible, but also he's guileless and tender and sweet and cheerful. He seems like the type of guy you probably would genuinely like to have around.
Well, and they become friends. Well, Salieri's faking it.
Yeah.
But outwardly, they become friends only after Salieri has vowed to God to destroy Mozart. And Mozart doesn't know that, of course. He actually seems to truly respect him more than he had early on. He'd rewritten that musical piece.
Yes.
Is it quite right,
Trifle.
Is it? And then instantly makes it way better, which you have to both respect and hate a guy for. I probably would, too, if I was in Salieri's shoes in that case. But Salieri's finally seeing into what this person really is and could maybe be in some way part of that, but it's still not good enough. And Mozart the whole time thinks he's a friend. Right to the very moment he dies, he thinks that this guy's actually his friend. The other comparison I want to make Salieri's like the sports writer in the modern era who was picked last in soccer who hates the steroid users. Because so many fans will say, hey, he's done roids. But they don't have the opportunity and the job, as it turns out, to write about these people and say some of the vitriolic things they've said. As if when they were in that same position, if they had to heal from an injury, try to stay in the game longer and be on top, they would never, ever take any kind of performance-enhancing drugs. And Salieri's that guy, too. I would never do the things that he does, but that's because he can't be in that position that he's in.
So God's love is like steroids for composers.
Could be. And then Salieri launches what we now call a smear campaign.
Mm-hmm.
He also does lie about him, about what he's actually doing, and he keeps him from getting the kinds of jobs and postings that he should have by just whispering in the emperor's ear and saying, no, not quite right. But not telling the emperor why he's not quite right. The truth, at least.
Employs a spy. A spy maid to live with the Mozarts.
Played by
Sex and the City's Cynthia Nixon.
Very young Cynthia Nixon.
Yeah, I spotted her right away. I don't know why. I think it was her voice. Yeah.
The trembling Cynthia Nixon.
Her performance is rather histrionic. Cool your jets, lady. It's not that upsetting. It's just a couple fighting.
Yeah, to always be like that is one thing. Maybe at the end when he is dying of, what'd you say it was? Cirrhosis of the liver?
I don't think they ever really say. I think it's meant to be some combination of cirrhosis plus pneumonia plus exhaustion.
One of the influences from this film, and my preferred film of the two, because I just like the movie better, is Immortal Beloved.
Mm.
And in fact, it was 10 years later, 1994. That's about Beethoven. Do we see a young Beethoven? It's portrayed that he is actually there when Mozart is playing some music. I think it's the scene where he's playing upside down.
Mm-hmm.
One of those big parties.
Yeah, they'd cut to a couple of conspicuous close-ups of a child.
But in Immortal Beloved, Beethoven's brother, and I don't know if this is based on reality either, maybe they took poetic license with that film also, but he dies of tuberculosis. He's coughing up blood and that kind of stuff, and you just wonder, what exactly is he dying of?
I always thought consumption was some disease that got cured at some point between the old world and the new world. But in all these old books and plays and movies, you know, people would die of consumption. I had no idea it meant essentially pneumonia or tuberculosis.
Mm-hmm. Didn't have the drugs back then to fix people and the proper medicine. And when you talk about death, at the end, Mozart is dumped in a mass grave.
Oh, yeah.
Which is also, obviously, a tragedy. There's no subtlety to that. He's just plumped right in there with everybody else. And they're definitely going to reuse that coffin, too.
It's a hinged door on it, for crying out loud.
Obviously, they do it with an awful lot of people. So you go through the pomp of a funeral that we all kind of expect at funerals in our own lives with our own family members and people we care about. But in this case, just... He means nothing. He's just pretty much in an unmarked grave with a bunch of other people.
It is incredible. If that's true, it must be true that Mozart doesn't have a marked grave because he died poor. But that's insane. That's such a beloved, important artist.
Mm-hmm. The film's reaction to Leopold, his father, and his death is to cut right away to the performance of Don Giovanni.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting take. We also see earlier on when the mother-in-law is shrieking at him and bellowing about what he hasn't done by her daughter. Eventually becomes the soprano, or you call it soprano, but anyway, the opera singer singing in one of his performances.
I love the connection in Don Giovanni with his father, and his relationship with his father is so well drawn because he's not just this villainous, looming father figure. Mozart really loves him.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think it's interesting that Salieri might well be fitting all the parameters that Mozart's father would judge a man by. He's responsible and mature and pious. Mozart's father would probably love him for a son.
And Salieri is also dedicated to music, which is what we see early on. He's got him as a young kid playing blindfolded, and you get the feeling that it's all about music all the time. But again, getting back to Whiplash, the movie, and Fletcher, if you want to be good at something, in this case music again in that movie, you got to do it all the time.
But you don't want to be good at something, you want to be the best at something. You want to be the best of your generation at something. Mm.
And not for everybody. I guess someone like Mozart doesn't have to just focus on that to be great at it. As they point out, one of his, or several actually, of his compositions, there's no corrections. It's one thing to write this brilliant music that Salieri can just hear in his own head as he's reading it off the page, but also to see, it's like he's taking dictation from God.
There's a lot of liberties taken in the historical accuracy of the film, but that's a widespread myth about Mozart, that he never made corrections. He made corrections, but... common legend about
it. But to keep on the sports thing I've been talking about so much in this podcast, I think the best athletes can't tell you how they can hit that ball or the jump shot or throw the football. They can't explain it. They just do it.
Well, there is a well-documented and understood phenomenon that if you start a child young enough learning specific tasks, whether it be music or chess or throwing a baseball, it doesn't just become muscle memory. It actually rewrites your brain in a specific manner to... be catered to those tasks. So maybe Salieri's fault, not of any fault of his, was that he didn't become full-time into music.
His father didn't care about music at all.
His father wouldn't give him the lessons that he needed when he was young enough. The way Mozart's father started him very young, I mean, obviously he was gifted as well, but you have to combine those two things to get that once-in-a-generation talent.
Okay, the cast. F. Murray Abraham, who was briefly in All the President's Men, that little cameo as the resting officer. Right. He was also in Scarface the year before this, which is not an AFI film, but I think people know that movie quite well. And then he's recently been on Homeland the last couple of years, the TV show. Walter Matthau almost had the role. He's a huge Mozart fan. I like Walter Matthau. He probably could have played this series well enough. We think of him as a comic actor and a little goofy. I think they made the right choice with Abraham, who was essentially a nobody. He'd done things before this, as we just said, but not anything that was a star. Nobody in this cast is a huge name. Jeffrey Jones, when we get to him in a minute, is the biggest name to come out of it even now, because Abraham has worked a lot. Well, then again, he did make The Simpsons at one point. Because Homer's got to home. Homer's got to go home and watch Inside the Actor's Studio. And then if you've seen the show, you know how that joke goes. Bev just gave it away.
And his performance is incredible. This is maybe not the biggest selling feature of the film, because I think the film has so, so much going for it. But he is wonderful. He's serious, but he's funny. There's so much nuance in his performance. He's doing one of your favorite things. He's an actor performing a part of somebody who's acting all the time. He's putting on a show for everybody and that doesn't have any idea that he's a big phony.
Especially when he pretends to like Mozart for about half the movie.
Yeah.
And to be helping him, even though he's actually destroying him.
There's so much duality in everything he does, but it comes through with all of its nuance. It's a really great performance.
And speaking of that whole thing about how Mozart doesn't know what's happening in reality, that Salieri's trying to destroy him, most movies would have that revelation towards the end, even if it was right before you die.
Yeah.
But he never figures it out. Nobody other than the audience and then him confessing to the priest know that he even did this at all.
Yeah, when he's crying out, "I killed Mozart," when he tries to kill himself at the beginning of the film, his people don't have any idea what he's talking about. It's the ravings of a madman, but it's in fact true.
And Vincent Schiavelli is the first person I think we see on screen. He certainly is in that scene early on. He was in One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest as well. Mm-hmm. He's acted a lot of times with Foreman movies. And you can really hear his Brooklyn accent coming through pretty strong in those early on scenes. Right away, they set that tempo that we may be over in Austria, but we're not going to sound like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Another guy with a small role, incidentally, Kenny Baker, R2-D2 in Star Wars. I don't know who he was, but you point out during the small people scene.
Oh,
that
yeah.
Foreman likes things like that, too. We saw that in Blade Runner, it was. And Kenny Baker must be one of those guys. One other thing about Abraham I want to point out, he might as well just say at one point, because he doesn't, but he might as well, "Father, why have you forsaken me?" Which is what Jesus supposedly said on the cross. Okay, Tom Hulce, who, as I said, is really more of a supporting character, but it is a damn good performance. I love him in Parenthood, which was 5 years after this film. He'd been in Animal House before this film, and he's been acting for a long time. But he's only been a handful of movies since 1994. He's done more TV stuff and acting on stage and whatnot. Apart from that laugh I've tried to do so badly in this, the other thing you gotta recognize him for is his John McEnroe-esque tantrums, because he does throw a few of those in this film. Abraham was the right choice for Salieri. I didn't read a lot of other people that are up for it, but there were a ton of people that could have played Mozart. Tim Curry was in the running for it. Mel Gibson was.
Wow.
Mark Hamill, probably based on his Star Wars fame, and even the young Kenneth Branagh. I think of all those names, he might have been the most interesting choice, and maybe even the best choice for it, but Hulce was great in the film. One other thing I said about Orson Welles is that Welles essentially had to grovel to get movies made, and he had to work for years to get anything going on, and that's kind of what comes out of Mozart. It isn't just a matter of saying, "I have this brilliant music here, back me up, somebody who can recognize this could be really good," because he won't play the game. And that is, as I said, a great comparison between Orson Welles and Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. The Emperor is Jeffrey Jones, sounding also very American. Everybody's got to know him from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. He was also in Beetlejuice a couple years later. And then I like him a lot in Ed Wood. And then I guess the worst thing about him is that he's a known sex offender.
Yeah, that's probably what he's most notorious for. Now, it's not necessarily his performances, but his criminal record.
Although one thing about his character I want to bring up right now, he does underplay it nicely. But if yawning was a bad sign in performances at the opera or movies, all filmmakers would hate me. I've fallen asleep through plenty of movies over the years. Oh, and it isn't because I'm bored by the movies very often. It's because I just fall asleep pretty easily with my weird work schedule, for one thing. And then Christine Ebersole, who is the opera singer, the one we see the most in the film, she was Linda in Tootsie, and then she was in Wolf of Wall Street just a couple of years ago. So had a pretty good career in her lifetime.
Another performer playing a performer in this movie, Simon Callow, plays the librettist in The Magic Flute. He's the vaudeville who is always dealing with Mozart. He played Mozart in the London stage play of Amadeus.
when we were watching the movie, I had just seen, not the whole thing, but a little bit of Shakespeare in Love, and I was looking through the credits while I was doing that. I was watching the last scene where they put on Romeo and Juliet, and then he is kind of a bad guy in that film, and I didn't know who he was until I looked through the credits, and I was trying to find him in this film early on when I saw his name in the credits for Amadeus, and of course he doesn't appear until maybe the last third or so, and I finally realized, oh, that's the same guy.
That's a great film to compare to Amadeus in general. You've got another popular play that became an Oscar-winning film that is rich with language and about a very famous, very talented artist.
Yeah, and most of what we see is behind the scenes. Shakespeare in Love portrays Romeo and Juliet, but it's more about the intrigue and the politics, of course, and trying to just get money to make the damn thing as well. Yes,
and also takes enormous liberties with history. Mm-hmm. You're not even meant to believe that any of that is
accurate.
That one
more so than Amadeus.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, the director, Milos Forman, he's made two AFI films, so he's done because he did do Cuckoo's Nest. And if you've never seen Man on the Moon or The People vs. Larry Flint, then check those two out from the 90s. His lead characters are generally rebels who buck the system, and then they suffer for it. He makes his characters pay. But he can relate to that because he came from Czechoslovakia when it was called Czechoslovakia. And that is a country that broke apart. And anyone who wanted to be a rebel or a naysayer to the people in charge were going to pay.
Yeah, he started out in the Czech New Wave filmmaking style, which was very realistic, and fighting against the USSR, that was pretty influential to him.
So between his two films then, Amadeus, Cuckoo's Nest, which do you like better?
I like Amadeus better. I know Cuckoo's Nest is probably the better film, but I just never loved Cuckoo's Nest, probably because I loved the book too much and so different from the book.
Just like being wrong, don't you?
I just admitted that it's definitely a better film, but I personally like Amadeus better for my money.
All right, the writer Peter Shaffer did base this on his own 1979 stage play. He also wrote Equus, which became a movie, Richard Burton. And then Equus went back on the stage later on. Daniel Radcliffe played not the Richard Burton character, but the other guy. The producer, Saul Zance, did produce Cuckoo's Nest. And then also The English Patient and some other films in there. So he's got at least three Oscars on his mantle, although I think maybe he might be dead now. His family members are all over the credits at the end. If you look during the credit roll at the end, it's Zance. And then a little bit later, Zance. And another one. And it's different names. It isn't the same person getting 15 credits. Okay, technically, a 2-3-5-1 film. And we did watch the DVD and the director's cut, like I said. Not a beautiful print, but it was fine. I'm sure the Blu-ray is probably better. The cinematographer, Miroslav Ondrasek. Ondrasek. I hope I'm pronouncing that name properly. If I'm not, I'm sorry, sir. He often worked with Milos Forman, then later on with Penny Marshall. I think he has as many credits with her as he did with Forman. He shot with natural light as much as he possibly could, and certainly primarily. The most famous example, other than this movie, of that would be the candlelight and natural light sequences in Barry Lyndon that Kubrick shot. Not with Ondrasek.
Whatever
his name is. But this movie was shot mostly without giant Klieg lights. The editors, Michael Chandler and Nina Denevich. Chandler became a writer and director of documentaries, and then Denevich later worked on Valmont, which was an adaptation of a movie you mentioned earlier today.
Yes.
Coincidentally, Dangerous Liaisons. Valmont, directed by Forman after the version that was made in 88. His was in 1990, so he came 2 years late to the party with that one, and no one really remembers Valmont. They all think of Dangerous Liaisons.
They're both really good movies, though. They really are.
The composer? Well, Wolfie, obviously.
Yes, yeah.
Mozart, all the music is him. And we agree when it was over that we can respect it and like the music, but I can't even actually hear it in my own head. If they played it on the piano, I'd recognize it. Like the scene early on when the priest hears the music, and, oh, I know that one!
Yeah.
And that makes Salieri nuts, because he wrote that. I wrote the ones you didn't recognize. But for me, Beethoven is the genius and the god of musicians. I was thinking about this, actually. People will go on, especially older people, about why music today stinks. And I did wonder this one thing, because I don't agree with them. I think that's not fair. Why are there no composers on this level, or even close to it, when we had so many in the span of that time? If this is historically accurate, and Mozart was around as a fairly young guy when Beethoven was a kid, those are two of the greatest ever that composed music. How come we aren't seeing that anymore? This is lucky.
You mean of
our modern era, real musicians? Yeah, if there are any people like that, I'm not hearing much about them.
Because if somebody loves music, if somebody's born with that affinity for music, they're just going to be way more likely to pick up guitar or turntable or computer or any other means of
or
making
be a film
music
composer.
That's popular. Be a film composer. That's a very good example right there. If somebody were to separate the work of John Williams or Ennio Morricone, I know I'm probably saying that wrong, right? Or Bernard Herrmann, if you were to just listen to those pieces of music on their own, I really think that they do stand up.
Yeah.
And in concert with the film, it's its own kind of special genius. But it's worth mentioning, it's just not a popular form of music right now. There are people who are composing,
we're not going to hear
music has changed. Yeah. There's still brilliant musicians. There's probably more opportunity for a really talented musician to find their niche and reach their potential now than there was in Mozart's time.
Except people that were talking about dwell on the Beatles. The Beatles were great musicians, but they're nothing close to Mozart and Beethoven. And if anyone wants to think they are, this is all opinion anyway, but I don't think they're even close to them. Why is no one achieving that? I have an answer to my own question.
Okay.
But I was setting you up for that. People were being paid by the emperor or the governor yes. or the president or the prime minister, whoever's in charge of the government, to do this. And then essentially they become the new father figure that says, you're doing this all the time. This is all you have in life. Well, at least that's all your job is going to have to be. Even though you may struggle to get by, as Mozart does, he isn't starving to death. He's able to do this for a long time. The movie portrays it's quite a few years because he does have a kid who gets to be...
I think it's 10 years.
Okay, there you go. That's maybe the answer to the question is that people were giving you the money. They're giving you a grant that you don't see nowadays, at least on this level.
I think history will show hundreds of years from now people may look back at the Beatles or they may look back at Radiohead and say, yeah, this actually is just as valuable as Mozart and Beethoven.
Okay.
I'm getting some skepticism over here.
I have no problem with those guys.
It's a different kind of music. It is a different
That's kind. True. We're comparing, as the expression goes, apples to oranges. All right, here's a credit we've not talked about a lot. Dick Smith won the Oscar for makeup. He's a genius. There's that word again, just like Mozart. He did makeup on Midnight Cowboy, both the Godfather films we've covered, Taxi Driver, and The Deer Hunter. Those are all AFI films, and now this one. Paul LeBlanc shared the Oscar with him because he was the hair guy, did most of those wigs that Mozart wishes he had three heads for. He also did work on Return of the Jedi the year before this, and then he later worked a lot with the Coen brothers. Smith would have won the Oscar mostly for the old age makeup that took forever to put on Abraham in those scenes we see set in the sanitarium.
Still to this day, I don't think I've seen better old age makeup than that. I know they do a lot of stuff digitally now, but that is stand-up makeup. It looks convincing. How often does that happen?
It's Dick Smith for you that he's so good at. I didn't mention The Exorcist because it wasn't an AFI film, but he did the makeup in that so convincingly to make Reagan, this little girl, 12-year-old Linda Blair, look like this psychotic demon. Okay, I said there wasn't a lot of influence in the film, but we covered some of the important ones. Bull Durham, which I didn't even think of until that moment, and then Whiplash is another one. But here's a few more. Being cursed with the knowledge that you're not good enough to ever be the best at something reminds me of It's a Wonderful Life and the Jimmy Stewart character. He's kind of Salieri. He doesn't lash out at anybody the same way that Salieri does, but he is willing to kill himself because he feels like his life has been worth nothing. And then he prays to God, and in that movie, God does save him.
God answers.
Sends the guardian angel.
Yeah. I wish more films had taken direction from Amadeus because I love this style. I love a good costume drama just like a lot of ladies. But I really prefer this style where it's believable and authentic and they don't get caught up in details like the accents and making everything look perfectly accurate, but instead putting me believably in the past. I wish that was something that we saw more of now.
Because so many costume dramas now get stuffy and they focus on that stuff. And then that wins an Art Direction Oscar for the sets, or it wins the costume Oscar,
yes.
or sometimes both, often both. But do people ever think of those films later on?
Yeah.
And maybe they don't think about this one either, but it was a success in its day, and it made this list, so that means something.
It's a bit of a left turn, but and I know I mentioned this movie a lot, but that same quality is something that we saw in 12 Years a Slave, where I suspect the details are probably pretty accurate in that film, but they did such a fantastic job of just making it look authentic and not storybooky.
It was like you were there, just dropped in a fly
on
the wall.
Yeah, it makes it so effective.
Mm-hmm. Okay, a few other influences then. Good Will Hunting. Stellan Skarsgård's character is Salieri, and Will is Mozart. I think when Damon Affleck wrote the screenplay, they knew that Skarsgård's character was absolutely Salieri. He wasn't trying to destroy anybody, but he was very good. He won a Fields Medal in mathematics. But he didn't have the ability to be even close to as good as Will Hunting is, and he knows it.
And also, Will Hunting is just naturally good at it.
As he even explains.
Yeah, he works at it, but he was born that way.
He could just play, was the expression he used in the film. And I don't know much about the song, we've all heard it, but how about the Falco song, Rock Me Amadeus?
Oh, come on.
Does it actually refer to this movie in any kind of way, or this guy? I don't know. I haven't heard the song in a long time.
Maybe he did a bunch of coke and then watched that movie and then stayed up all night
and
that song.
I think the song was released in 1986.
Is it 86?
Only a few years after this movie was out.
Yeah, maybe.
And it won the Oscars in the early 85, so it would have been on the guy's mind around that time. Okay, the awards and the list section isn't long, except for the very first part. The Oscars, it won 8. That's the most we've had in a very long time. Best Picture for Saul Zantz. Best Director for Milos Forman, his second after Cuckoo's Nest. Best Actor for F. Murray Abraham. Very nice little speech. Abraham's very gracious in it. Schaffer's screenplay, the sets, the costumes, the sound, and Dick Smith's makeup on Paula Blank's wigs as well. The three nominations that didn't win were Best Actor because Hulse was nominated against Abraham, the editing, and the cinematography. Here we go again. We had this last week, Sophie's Choice. Now, Amadeus, Congress is not preserving this film in the National Film Registry, maybe because, as I said, it's leaning more towards not being an American film at all, except with the actors. Made by Orion, which is an American company, and that's what matters the most anyway. That's why those lean films are considered American more than anything else, because they are produced and released by American companies. The only other AFI recognitions of any kind were just nominations. They didn't even make the lists, but top 100 quotes. There are simply too many notes. That is so pulled out of their behinds, it's funny. And then we said already Salieri's a top 50 villain. Would have been a good choice and probably should have made it over some of those villains. I like the heroes and villains list. Some of them are debatable. And as we've done this top 100 project, we come across some names you think, that is also diversifying. It's easy to put a gangster in. There's plenty of gangsters on the list. But how about somebody like this, who, as we've said 100 times already in this podcast, is so relatable. Mm-hmm. He is so us. He's all of us. Way more than any of us can ever be Mozart. Okay, we like the film, and I think we agree, or at least I feel like it shouldn't have been a top 100 film, but I don't have a problem with it being there. I'm not against the idea of it, but I wouldn't put it in my 100.
I disagree. I think it should be in the top 100.
Okay.
It fits the criteria.
No, I don't think it does. It wasn't a monster hit. It didn't really influence that much. We brought some influences into this that I didn't expect to find. It didn't make a lot of other AFI lists.
It still is a pretty well-liked film. Like you said, it's in the top 100 on IMDb.
Mm-hmm.
So then that's a viewer-voted system.
Well, I like to mention that, but it's not really a credible
No, one. But it's a popularity contest worth mentioning when the public loves a film. I think people need to, if they haven't seen it in a while, if they've forgotten whatever made it so great, I think they need to go and watch it again.
We've been told by our listeners, our friends at least, to try to listen to all of our podcasts, that they do stick with the films that they know. I think a few of our friends will not be hearing anything we've said because they're not going to listen to this because they've probably not seen this movie.
And I'm saying putting it on the list, keeping it on the list, will get more people to see it, which they should, because it is absolutely a worthwhile piece of work.
Which is the best thing about the AFI's top 100 list.
Absolutely. All anyway. But I say put it back on the list. This is the kind of film that should be rewarded. It's entertaining. It's unique. It's deep. It's full of artistry. I love it. Amadeus forever.
It's really,
the end. Bye, bye, bye.
It's very good. I'm not saying that at all. Okay, up next on the Top 100 Project is another Best Picture Oscar winner. The War as Hell Vietnam flick, Oliver Stone's Platoon. So the coming attractions trivia for Platoon. It made nearly twice as much money as Oliver Stone's second biggest hit. And I don't mean AFI films here. I just mean his actual movies, all of them, because he only ever had the one AFI film anyway. What's the rest of his top five at the box office?
Ooh, curious to learn about that. So for the answer to that question, please tune into next week's podcast for Platoon. If you'd like more trivia from Ryan and me, along with all kinds of other fun stuff, including links to some of the things that we talked about in today's podcast, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes, where you can also find our back catalog of podcasts about all the films that came before Amadeus. So please check out our roster of podcasts. And you can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. If you'd like to reach Ryan and I, you can reach us through the website, and you can also send us a personal email at top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
This podcast has simply too many words.
And cut.